I'd like to call this meeting of the House Resources Committee to order. Time is 1:26 p.m. Today is Friday, March 8, 2019. Members present are Representatives Tuck, Hannon, Tallarico, Sponholz, Rauscher, Rasmussen, Vice Chair Hopkins, and myself, Representative Lincoln. Please let the record reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business, and before we get started, please silence your cell phones. Assisting us today is our recording secretary, Ms. Debbie Tillinghast, and our LIO moderator, Eric Heimbigner. Our first order of business is Senate Joint Resolution 7, endorsing Anwar Leasing. This resolution has zero fiscal notes, and it is the intention of the co-chairs to take final action on the resolution today. Senator Birch, would you like to provide some initial comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for the opportunity to be here this afternoon and for your consideration in taking up this joint resolution. In consideration of amendments, which I know have been discussed, I'd like to remind members of the tight deadline for this resolution. Comments on the Anwar Leasing Program draft EIS close on Wednesday, March 13th at 9:59 p.m. The purpose of this resolution is to serve as the 31st legislature's official comment on that draft. If SJR 7 has a good fortune of passing out of committee unamended, it could get a second reading on the House floor on Monday and a third reading and passage on Wednesday in time to make the 9:59 deadline. If this resolution passes out amended, it would have to go back to the Senate for concurrence, which would delay final passage and thus miss the March 13th deadline by a minimum of 2 days. Thus, in your consideration of amendments, I ask that you be mindful of that a vote for an amendment could very well serve as a vote against timely passage. I ask you not to let the perfect be the enemy of the good and urge you to consider allowing the resolution to pass out of committee intact so that it may serve its intended purpose. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Are there any questions from committee members for the resolution sponsor?
Great. Thank you.
Okay, seeing none, there are some amendments that committee members would like to entertain. Representative Hopkins had, I know we had asked committee members to have legal draft amendments. Representative Hopkins did so, but he wishes to separate the amendment that was drafted into two separate amendments, which were distributed, labeled amendments 1 and amendments 2. You want to just... or that are being distributed, and we'll take a brief at ease while he does that. Representative Hopkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So Amendment 1 and Amendment 2 are both identical to the language that was in the single amendment that we have in front of us that was drafted by Legislative Legal, but we broke them out. So Amendment 1 is the second whereas, and it states, and it is identical to the language that you see in front of you with one small change, I believe. And I'll mention that in a second. It changes a must to a may. So the full Amendment 1 states, whereas to protect the state's record of successful development, the input of the Gwich'in and Inupiat people who currently and traditionally reside in the North Slope Borough and the Yukon-Koyukuk census areas may be taken into consideration, and the full effects of development on the porcupine and central Arctic caribou herds on which they traditionally rely, as well as the full environmental effects of the infrastructure needed to bring the resources to market, may be addressed through the environmental permitting process. And dot dot dot. So the only change from the First Amendment that you have that where it's combined to this one is the language. The Gwich'in and Inupiat people who currently and traditionally reside in the North Slope Borough and the Yukon-Koyukuk census areas may be taken into consideration, and that's line 5 on Amendment 1. We changed that must to may. And do I need to move it? I make a motion. Mr. Chairman, I move to amend the motion by inserting in Amendment 1.
And I'll object for the purpose of discussion. Would you like to speak to your amendment?
Much as I just said, the language is, thank you, Mr. Chairman, The language is nearly identical with the change from a must to a may. The point of this is to make sure that we take the opportunity to hear from those who have utilized the area, traditionally utilized these caribou herbs that are the two predominant herds in the Arctic slope, the porcupine and the, in Anwar, the porcupine and the central Arctic caribou herds. They've been relied on for thousands of years traditionally, and many in populations both in the Gwich'in Alaska Native people, which is more in the interior, the northern part of the interior, and the villages there, represented in District 6, much of it, making sure that they are taken into consideration, as well as the full environmental impacts of not just the small footprint in the 1002 area, but also the feeder lines to the central processing unit, the additional seismic activity and ice roads that would need to be built over to the area, and all of the infrastructure needed to bring these important resources to market. So that's what this resolution is working towards.
Representative Rasmussen?
I appreciate the language in the amendments, and I definitely do think it's important to get feedback from residents from the area. My only concern at this point is the time that we have left with public testimony closing in less than a week. I'm just very concerned about any amendments prohibiting us from getting this back out in time.
Thank you, Representative Rauscher.
Yeah, thank you. I did owe the 7 minutes on the time, but I also want I question what we're actually saying in the whereas. Are we talking to the caribou herd itself? Are we talking to the location of those that reside there? Both? Or I guess when you see the word may, and now it talks about porcupine herds, it seems like we're actually talking about them more than we are talking about location, but I don't know, and I'm just asking for clarification because that's what I'm trying to understand here.
Mr. Chairman, take me to...
Yeah, Representative Hopkins, but first I want to note to the committee that we do have Faith Martineau with the Office of Project Management and Permitting on the line if there's any questions that she can help with. So, Representative Hopkins?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It would be taking into consideration the impact on the caribou herds and their migration patterns, how they would be impacted in their calving grounds in the footprint of the 1002 area where the development would be taking place. So specifically to them in regards to the caribou herds, doing assessments into their population, assessments into how they've grown or shrunk over the years, and what is known to impact caribou calving grounds as well, to see what that impact long-term could be on those herds.
Thank you.
Representative Sponholz.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I just wanted to address not the amendment, but the concern about timeline, if that's okay. I think one of the things that we have seen sort of traditionally as it relates to resolutions in support of developing in the Alaska National Wildlife Refuge is that there's been sort of really widespread support for them. They've passed really with significant margins traditionally. And that it is very easily, we can very easily waive the uniform rules to move from first into second on Monday in order to meet the objective of getting this resolution both, to a place that I think more people are comfortable with the language and meeting the objective of the timeline. So I think that we can achieve all of those goals without missing the important EIS testimony timeline on Wednesday. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to remind everybody that when this resolution, a resolution similar to this, hit the floor 2 years ago, it went back, kicked back to rules, back on the floor, back to rules, this and that. So if we don't do our work here in committee, I'm afraid that we're going to end up having problems on the floor. And this is something that was debated one time before. We ended up putting it in the resolution. I think it's appropriate that we do have this language in there when we're looking at developing in people's backyards. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Rep. Rasmussen, do you have something?
I guess my other question or comment is, are these amendments appropriate to the the BL, yeah, Bureau of Land Management. I almost feel like it would be more helpful to have a second resolution maybe that goes to Congress, because what we're trying to accomplish here seems more appropriate to go to Congress, whereas the resolution that we're working on for SJR 7, it seems to be a different topic, I guess, if that makes sense.
Mr. Rauscher?
Thank you. Through the chair, I was just wondering if I could ask the senator a question.
Senator Birch, would you like to join us, please?
You bet.
Senator Chris Birch, for the record.
And I haven't been following this very closely, so I have to apologize. But were these brought up in the Senate, these amendments?
They were not.
They were not. Were they discussed at all in the Senate?
I think there's been some discussion around the edges on some aspect, but nothing formal.
Did it seem like there was going to be any kind of a acceptance on these, since you said they were somewhat discussed?
Through the chair, I think the one comment that did happen on the floor is it was pointed out that the whereas on page 3, line 6, says, whereas the state continues to strive to ensure the ongoing health and productivity of the porcupine and central Arctic caribou herds and the protection of land, water, and wildlife resources during the exploration development of the coastal plain of Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. The discussion on the floor, the comment on the floor, was that this was adequately addressed in that context. I would note that as a sidebar that I did the porcupine caribou herd specifically is at the high point of all time at 218,000 animals at this as of last summer.
And through the chair, one more question, follow-up question. If these were to actually be implemented, how would they be? How would the do you view, in your opinion, the Senate would look at these toward getting the goal accomplished, which is passing the bill?
Through the chair, I don't think there's any serious issues with any of the resolutions in that context. I think we're looking at a time consideration here. We did pay particular note to the fact that this is not going to Congress. It's basically going to the BLM and the Department of Interior with the objective of them just moving the ball forward on the process of a lease sale. To that end, we did not. There's four different alternatives identified, and we tried to stay away from saying, well, you ought to look at this alternative or that alternative. So it's agnostic, if you will, on alternative. It's just saying, let's move the ball forward. I think from the standpoint of when you start using language like full effects of development on caribou herds, addressing those and development infrastructure, we might be setting an unattainably high bar for state and federal regulators, because the permitting typically aims to address reasonable foreseeable environmental impacts, I think is the language, rather than full effects. So it's all nuanced. At this point, I guess we felt it was just good to move the ball forward.
I've got a question.
Thank you.
I don't know if this, sorry, Representative Rauscher, so, and this is comment on the lease sales, which is a sort of initial, one of the earlier steps in development, and any sort of project that would come later would need its own permitting and environmental review and the rest also, right?
Correct.
You have something?
No, I appreciate it. Thank you very much for allowing me to ask questions.
Representative Tallarico?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I just want to point out that within the actual draft EIS that BLM has already produced with four different potential decisions that they could make, which could be amended a little bit, but BLM has been in contact with the Arctic Village Council, the Inupiaq community of the Arctic Slope, Native Village of Kaktovik, Venati Village Council, Native Village Venati Tribal Governments, Beaver Village, Birch Creek Tribal Council, Chalkitsik Village Council, the Gwich'in Tribal Government, which is located in Fort Yukon, Anituvik Pass, Native Village of Barrow, the Inupiat Traditional Government, the Native Village of Nuiqsut, and the Native Village of Stevens. So it's no doubt these folks have been in, BLM has been in contact, and this was for consulting purposes as they developed this. They're also still consulting with the Arctic Slope Regional Corporation and the Kaktovik Inupiaq Corporation, which is part of the Department of Interior's policy for consultation with ANCSCA corporations. So since this is going to BLM, I'm opposed to the amendment, just due to the fact that I think the agency has done their due diligence in this process, and that's clearly pointed out on page 5 of the executive summary of the it would be the Coastal Plain Oil and Gas Leasing Program, the draft environmental impact statement. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Tallarico. Any other questions or comment from the committee members? Senator Birch.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would note that we did have extensive testimony during the Senate Resources hearing on this same resolution. We had very solid support at the North Slope Borough, Arctic Slope Regional Corporation, and the community most immediately adjacent to the 1002 area, and that was the village of Kaktovik. So we had actually a fair amount of commentary and engagement. All positive and supportive.
Thank you. Would you like to wrap up, Representative Hopkins?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As the sponsor of the resolution said, this is a resolution going to Congress, or sorry, going to the BIA, and to urge moving forward in the draft EIS, in the EIS process. And this would urge them to continue working alongside the Gwich'in and Inupiat people as they have been doing within the draft EIS process, making sure that they continue to move forward with that. It is very good to hear in my meetings with Senator Birch earlier today that the porcupine herd is at an all-time high. We need to ensure that what action we take on this resolution and in moving forward in developing the lands, that those herds continue to remain that high, and we need to make sure that the action we take and action taken to develop this land is and develop these resources does not have a substantially negative impact on those herds and to maintain it there. And this is not this amendment going into the resolution would not change any of the bars that we're asking or that we're requiring the full EIS process to undertake. It simply would urge them to make sure that they look at these specific issues, continuing to take into account the work they've already done with the Gwich'in and the Inupiat people, and making sure that they look at the full impact of the infrastructure needed to bring these resources to market. And so I ask everyone to join me in supporting this amendment so that we can ensure that we get the input and the necessary environmental acts, the environmental things that we look at within the EIS, into that EIS ahead of time so that we don't bog it down with litigation later. And so I urge us to support this Amendment 1. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Hopkins. And considering the discussion, including the fact that the original resolution includes language on the state's priority for the caribou herd, the history of consultation with different indigenous groups and communities and organizations in and around the area, I'm going to maintain my objection and at this time ask for the roll. Brief eddies. And we are back on record.
Representative Tuck?
Yes.
Representative Hannon?
Yes.
Representative Hopkins?
Yes.
Representative Rasmussen?
No.
Representative Rauscher?
No.
Representative Sponholz?
Yes.
No.
Co-Chair Lincoln?
No. So with a vote of 4 yeas and 4 nays, amendment number 1 is not adopted. Moving on to amendment number 2.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move the amendment number 2. I move to amend the motion by inserting amendment number 2. And that amendment reads, should I read it?
Yes, please.
That amendment reads, whereas while most Alaskans support the development in the coastal plain of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, many do so with the understanding that the state's workforce will be used to the maximum extent possible if the leasing program moves forward. And dot, dot, dot.
And I will object. Would you like to speak to your amendment, Representative Hopkins?
Yes, sir, Mr. Chairman. This language is taken out of many of the past resolutions that the legislature has passed, urging Congress, as a full Congress, to move forward in this process of developing the 1002. I wanted to make sure that we had language in there specifically ensuring that the EIS process looks at the benefits of to the state as a whole, and also urging Congress once that language moves forward, because as the sponsor said, there would be numerous draft or EIS processes going forward and numerous stops at Congress before this land is, and resources are developed. I wanted to make sure that we urge them to make sure from the very get-go that we are putting Alaskans to work for Alaskans' resources. There have been a number of questions about the constitutionality of that action by Congress. At the state level, we all know we cannot mandate Alaska Hire. During my research, I found out that you can mandate Alaska Hire at the municipal level if you only use municipal dollars for a project. And Congress, by the U.S. Constitution, is able to regulate interstate commerce and commerce across the country. So this would not be an unconstitutional step based on our research on putting Alaskans to work for Alaskans' resources. So I ask the committee to support us in making sure Alaskans get the benefit of our lands and our resources.
Thank you, Representative Hopkins. Any questions or comment from the committee members? Representative Rauscher.
Brief at ease.
Brief at ease. Representative Rauscher, do you have a question? Or?
I think at this time, I'd just like to make a statement. I've tried to write a few bills in the past to address these problems, and legislature is constantly brought back. It's unconstitutional. And so I have a difference of opinion with the information that was just stated, and that's just my statement right now. Thank you.
I guess I'm not clear. So you have a difference of opinion on Hopkins' statement on the constitutionality of the request?
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. Thank you.
Can I clarify it?
Yes, sir. Many people have tried to put into statute at our state level what would be allowed in terms of who is hired onto these projects and things like that. But at the federal level, Congress is allowed to regulate commerce in between states. And the past resolutions to Congress in support of opening up ANWR and the 1002 and developing this property has had language urging them to open up or to use Alaskan Hire. So this is not a unique language. This is not unique language that we're putting into this resolution that we have not seen and voted for in the past. Yes, sir.
Senator Birch, you'd like to respond to that?
I was just going to point out that what is unique about this this resolution is that does not go to Congress, and the Congress is actually the deciders, if you will, on the issue of hire. I don't think there's anybody that quibbles with the importance of Alaska Hire at any point in time. Matter of fact, whereas on the third page, line 10 says, whereas polling consistently shows Alaskans overwhelmingly support responsible oil and gas development in the non-wilderness portion of Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. That was put in there because we had a poll that said 64% of Alaskans support oil and gas. I'm not, familiar with, polling that may have been done in this particular resolution situation, but I do know that the fact that the resolution is directed towards kind of the administrative side, it's not going to Congress, it's going to the administration BLM as far as it relates to the draft EIS and a comment just to, kind of move it forward. So this wouldn't really focus on or be directed to somebody that can actually make a decision that way. Again, back to the point we had earlier, It takes a three-quarter vote, I think, to Representative Sponholz's earlier comment to go to a second or third reading. So we are worried about getting our shoelaces tied together on from a timing standpoint. So, but I do think that the resolution that we have in here that says the support for resource development, and we'll have ample opportunity to set that up down the road.
Thank you, Rep. Tallarico.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And my biggest concern with this is we have discussed constitutionality a lot. In 1977, it was the Hicklin versus Orbeck case that went before the Supreme Court of Alaska. Justice Connor produced the opinion of the decision that was made, and on page 2 of the opinion, section 2, they clearly stated that durational residence requirements are subject to strict scrutiny under the equal protection clauses of the federal and state constitutions because they penalize those who have exercised their fundamental right of interstate migration. And for that particular reason, I don't believe this opinion has ever been overturned or changed. So for that particular reason, I won't be supporting the amendment. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Rep. Tallarico. Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I support the amendment. As was pointed out by the maker of the amendment, that the Interstate Commerce Clause can be handled at the federal level. Who better to handle it than the President of the United States? This is going to the President of the United States. And any time that we can communicate that we're all about local hire, I think we need to take the opportunity to do that. This is a whereas, not a therefore. And I also want to point out that the language is workforce will be used to the maximum extent possible. What's wrong with that? Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any other questions or comment from committee members? Senator Bush, do you have any additional comment on the amendment?
I don't see it as necessary at this time. I think we've got language in here. I think it's clear that it's to the extent that this resolution is being directed to the BLM and as it relates to the draft EIS. I hadn't considered the questions of constitutionality, but I'm more concerned about just the additional time necessary to get this through the review process.
Thank you. Representative Hopkins, would you like to wrap up?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, thank you very much. I fully respect the timeline that we're looking at. It was good to hear that it was 10:59 or 9:59 p.m. On the 13th, this coming Wednesday, as opposed to 5 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. So it was good research that we found to allow us to make the changes and to be able to move it from second reading to third reading on Monday. As we've seen from the packet by the sponsors, the number of people that have voted in favor of this resolution over the last 16 years or so, those vote counts enable us to move forward on moving it from second reading to third reading on Monday in the House in order so that the other body has the opportunity to pass it and get it in time before 9:59 p.m. Alaska time. And again, this is just a request that Alaskans receive the maximum benefit for our resources through jobs as well as what might come in revenue. And so I urge you to join me in supporting Alaskan hire and a maximum benefit for our resources. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. And I will withdraw my objection. Would anyone else like to object? Representative Rauscher?
I would like to object.
Okay, thank you. Ms. Tillinghast, will you call the roll, please?
Representative Hanna?
Yes.
Representative Hopkins?
Yes.
Representative Rasmussen?
No.
Representative Rauscher?
No.
Representative Sponholz?
Yes.
Representative Tallarico?
No.
Yes.
Representative Lincoln.
Yes. With a vote of 5 yea and 3 nay, the amendment is adopted. Are there any questions or additional comment with regards to the resolution? Hearing none, we've had two hearings on this bill now, taking testimony from the public, residents of the North Slope industry, and those opposed to development in Anwar. The goal is to take final action on the resolution today, And I'd like to acknowledge and thank those who provided public testimony on Wednesday. Your comments are important as we consider moving this resolution forward. At this time, a motion would be in order to forward the resolution.
Mr. Co-Chair.
Representative Hopkins.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I move to report SJR 7 labeled 31-LS0544/M as amended with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
Is there an objection? There being no objection, Senate Joint Resolution 7, as amended with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note, will move from the committee. Brief eddies. Thank you for joining us, Mr. Vincent Lang. Please put yourself on the record and introduce yourself to the committee.
My name is Doug Vincent Lang. I'm the Commissioner Designee for the Alaska Department of Fish and Game.
Would you like to provide an initial statement about your interest in serving as commissioner?
Yes, please. Thank you. Through the chair, my name is Doug Vincent Lang again. I grew up in Wisconsin. As a young man, I learned to hunt and fish with my grandfather, Otto, from a boat in southeastern Wisconsin. Learned many happy hours learning how to fish panfish and learning how to hunt waterfowl from my grandfather. It was good times. After growing up in Wisconsin, graduating high school, I went to the University of Wisconsin-Green Bay and attended that school and graduated in 1978 with a undergraduate degree in population dynamics and biology. And after graduating, I wanted to pursue my true vision, which was to become an oceanographer. I'd actually gone to a year of school in Florida after graduation from high school to pursue oceanography, but for a variety of fiscal reasons, I went back to Wisconsin and couldn't afford Florida for 4 years. But then I applied to graduate schools all around the nation, and one of the schools I was accepted to was Alaska, and I figured that was a great adventure. So traveled north in August of 1978 to pursue my degree in biological oceanography from the University of Alaska Fairbanks. Got to Fairbanks, and I got to tell you, I was looking for the ocean, and I spent a little bit of quality time wondering what I really got myself into when on August 28th it snowed 3 or 4 inches. But I stuck it out, graduated from my University of Alaska Fairbanks in 1980, December, with a degree in biological oceanography, and spent the next 6 months working between Fairbanks and the North Slope of Alaska doing biological oceanography and chemical oceanography work on the North Slope. And then I was offered an opportunity to come down to Anchorage and start with the Department of Fish and Game. I started on the Susitna Hydro Project in 1981. Spent 4 or 5 years studying the potential impacts of a hydroelectric development on the Susitna River. And best probably career job I had with the Department of Fish and Game, given a river boat and up and down the river, just looking for fish and characterizing their habitat and their flow requirements. A great job. After the Susitna Hydroelectric Project ended, I went to work for the Division of Sport Fish and spent about 20 years in the Division of Sport Fish doing a wide range of different activities from being an assistant area management biologist in Seward, eventually became a regional management coordinator and regional research coordinator for marine fisheries, sport fisheries in the south central part of Alaska, North Gulf Coast. Was involved in rockfish fisheries, lingcod fisheries, most marine salmon fisheries, and really got Sport Fish Division involved in the council activities with respect to halibut. Got involved in statewide rainbow trout management policies and a wide range of different statewide policies affecting the Sport Fish Division. Also was involved in the construct of the Fairbanks and Anchorage hatcheries and the way they were bonded using a license surcharge, which was unique across the United States in a way to build hatcheries that were primarily benefiting sport fishermen. After that, I went into the commissioner's office and worked on a couple of commissioner level policy issues, including Arctic policy, marine policy. I was involved in the rural sub cabinet and also involved in Endangered Species Act activities. And did that for about 6 years and then 7 years. And then the last four years I was the director of wildlife conservation. And then I retired 4 years ago and was living a retired life, and that's a pretty good life. But I got a phone call a couple months ago from the governor and asked me if I'd be interested in serving as the commissioner of Fish and Game. And I think I told most of you I took some time to consider that because I know how hard this job is and I know how controversial it can be. So I wanted to get my personal commitment to be able to do it, as well as my family's commitment to have their name in the newspaper again, because we share the same last name. And after thinking it through and getting those commitments myself with my family, I decided to put my name in for it. And since then, I've been challenged. It is a challenging job. I won't lie to you. It's a hard job, but it's a very rewarding job, and it's very, I guess rewarding is the right word, rewarding to serve as a commissioner of the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. I got a couple basic philosophies that I bring to the job. One is that these are public trust resources. They're not my resources. The public's entrusting the management of these public trust resources to me. To do my job correctly, I got to have their trust, and to have their trust, I got to be out communicating with people. So over the last 3 months, I've been spending a lot of time talking to people, just learning what their interests are. Because again, we're not always going to agree at the end of the day, but unless we're talking about it and learning from each other, I'm not going to have their trust, and it's not going to go much further. And leadership, I think I have an obligation to talk to my staff and seek their input on decisions I'm making. Again, we're not going to agree at the end of the day, but they can hold me accountable, and they should be holding me accountable if I haven't reached down into staff asking them about their opinions and on decisions that I'm making. I got a couple goals. One is to put food on the tables of Alaskans. I think one of the key things of Alaska's fish and game resources are to feed our families, and I want to find ways to put food on the tables of Alaskans. I want to ensure trust. Again, that's getting back to the public trust doctrine that I believe in. Preserving the state right to manage. I think we fought hard at statehood to get the right to manage our fish and game resources. We fought hard, as that was the basic premise of our Statehood Act. During ANILCO, we fought hard to maintain those rights to manage, and I don't think we should be afraid to fight hard now to keep those. And again, I think our Constitution should guide how we're managing our resources, not positions of biodiversity rather than active management. And finally, I want to ensure the next generations of hunters and fishers and anglers, most importantly, the next generation of wildlife and fishery scientists. I'm really worried when I look down the pipeline and seeing, trying to get positions hired in my department. It's becoming increasingly hard. We're increasingly having to look outside. So I want to look for ways to get our youth involved in fish and game management and resource issues, and hopefully convince them that that's a good career to take. And again, I want to get people, our kids, away from iPhones and iPads and out in the field. I too often see that kids are getting divested from fishing game resources, and I think they need to get outside more and participate. I'll take on a couple things right off the bat. I know I've been criticized because I don't have a lot of commercial fish background. I have a good fisheries background. I may not have grown up in the commercial fish division, but I've been around the commercial fish division and the issues facing it. And right off the bat, I knew that that was going to be a criticism, so I've reached out to most of the commercial fishing industry groups across the state of Alaska, especially when I was making hires for the North Council seat and as making hires for commercial fish director. And I think they're quite happy with who we selected. I've heard nothing but positive feedbacks on that. And I've been learning a lot about the commercial fisheries across our state. And trust me, I wouldn't take this job unless I understood the value and the return on investment in commercial fisheries across our state. It's incredibly important. And also, it's incredibly important that in rural Alaska that we have commercial fishing, because you can provide for subsistence and feed families, but unless you have an income, you're not going to be in that village for long. So, and number two is Prop 1. I was opposed to Prop 1. I did not believe, and I still do not believe, that it was right to rewrite our Title 16 permitting authorities with respect to a voter initiative. It was much too complex. That said, I do support looking at our Title 16 permitting authorities and taking a look at Prop 1 and updating as necessary as we move forward, and I've asked my staff to do that. And finally, active management. I do support active management of fish and game resources. And I read the Constitution. I read a lot of the background information that went into our Constitution, and I don't think our founders of our Constitution, the natural resources section, meant for our populations to be managed based on natural diversity. I think they were meant to be managed actively for the benefit of Alaskans and the benefit of our economy.
Thank you. Any questions or comment from committee members? Representative Sponholz.
Thank you, Co-Chair Lincoln. I just want to follow up on your comment about your being open to updating Title 16. You want to elaborate on that a little bit more?
Yeah, so I've asked my Habitat staff, and over the next year and a half, looking at Prop 1 and looking at whether there's things that we could take out of Prop 1 that would actually need to be updated in our Title 16 permitting authority. I don't have specifics yet. I just recently gave that direction to our Habitat staff and a couple people on our staff, and I think they'll be going through that over the next months.
So what motivates that? If you think that the components of Proposition 1 were bad, why would you propose exploring elements of it now?
Because I think the way that Prop 1 was written, it was very specific and very detailed. I don't think the average voter was looking at the details of it. That said, I think there are some components of it. For instance, updating, it's been a long time since we looked at our Title 16 permitting authority. I think it is appropriate to look at it, just like we would any regulatory package, to find out whether or not some things could be updated or some things could be improved in that process.
Follow-up? Do you have a specific example?
I think there are pieces of it where it intercedes with other regulatory forums, and we could take a look at it. For instance, is it necessary to have every body water in the state of Alaska identified as a potential anadromous stream? Mm-hmm. Is there a way that we could make that so that it's less than everybody, but more likely a body that could have anadromous fish in it? Mm-hmm. There's things like that that I think we could explore.
Oh, thank you.
Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you let us know what commissioner that you had worked under when you're talking about dealing with the hatcheries, and then you worked under Commissioner, but I didn't hear which commissioner that was.
Okay.
You worked side by side. You worked in the commissioner's office, is what you said.
Yeah. When I worked, I'm trying to think back on that, when we built the hatcheries in Hollow. I kind of worked in the commissioner's office through Commissioner Duffy, Commissioner Mackay Campbell, Denby Lloyd, and Cor Campbell, off and on doing different things. With respect to the hatcheries,
I think it was after that. Then you said you worked in the commissioner's office, okay. And so I was just trying to figure out which commissioner it was.
Okay.
All right, thank you.
Representative Rasmussen.
Yes, thank you. You mentioned wanting to get kids outside, and as a mom with young kids, I would love to hear your ideas on any collaboration or any programs that we could look at to get our kids outside.
Okay. Well, we just had a big event in Anchorage where we had over 1,000 different kids coming out from the schools for the Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, and then on the weekend we had a family fishing day, and that was a great opportunity to get kids out. I went out actually on the Saturday, came back from here to go out and do that, and couldn't believe the excitement, kids catching blackfish out of Sand Lake. It was really cool seeing some kids catching their first fish. So I think we need to look at those opportunities. We have a partnership with a foundation now with the department, and that foundation conducts an annual charity shoot, and that money is brought back in to do things like becoming an outdoor woman, family outdoor events. So we have to look at all those different kinds of activities.
Quick follow-up. Is there currently a budget with Fish and Game for this type of activity?
Yeah, there's budget activities both within the Division of Wildlife Conservation and the Division of Sport Fish.
Representative Hopkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Commissioner. Could not agree putting, I remember a lot more trips and fishing trips and hiking trips and camping trips with my family than sitting inside watching movies with them. And that was before we had iPhones. You said you worked on the Susit in the Dam project in the 1980s. Were you at all involved in it when it came back up in the 2000s?
No.
Do you think there was adequate work being done on the Susit in the Dam in terms of fish habitat, riparian habitat, the impacts of that dam, and it was brought up in the 2000s as you saw it being done in the 80s?
Well, I think I was asked whether or not there was the information that we had collected in the 1980s was being used and was adequate to make a decision when it was brought back up. As of any case, when you have information that's brought up that information should be used, but it should be updated. So I think that's exactly what I told him. I don't think any of the data we collected should be discarded just simply because it was old. Rather, it should be formed the foundation, and then it should be updated with new information as necessary.
Thank you. Just a quick follow-up. And I guess this is a statement on that side. I worked closely on the Susitna Dam project in those 2000s, getting it through the legislature and getting funding for that. And there was data going back decades, because they've been studying that since the 40s. And I could not agree more that we do need to look at that new data and how it's impacted in the Devil's Canyon one dam project versus the two with the larger reservoir and what it could do. And while they had lots of stream put data, I think making sure we spent the time and the money to look at what those impacts would be as opposed to just what we'd seen 30 years ago was critical. So I agree with you completely. Thank you.
Representative Chuck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Looking at your Division of Wildlife Conservation, and I think you mentioned that putting food on the table, I think a lot of that has to do with predator control as well. I know that aerial wolf hunting is going to be a part of that. What's the best time of year to be doing the aerial wolf hunting?
Well, springtime. So let me talk a little bit, about intensive management. When I was the Director of Wildlife Conservation, we actually moved intensive management from something that the legislature had approved into what I consider a more scientifically based system. We actually adopted a science policy to guide that. So the department doesn't just do intensive management. It'll study a population. When the population is not meeting the needs according to the legislature of the population, at that point in time, it triggers a review by us. We then go to the Board of Game, and the Board of Game then decides whether or not to approve an intensive management plan. And that approval then dictates how we can actually go out and do that. So before we can do it, we have to have an assessment of the population, the impacts of intensive management. The board approves it. Then they give us a plan back. And on an annual basis or semi-annual basis, we have to go back to them and show what was removed, is it working, in order to continue that operation. In no cases are we allowed to go take more of the predators in the population than could sustain the population of predators out in the field, and the uses that those predators provide. So in some cases, there's trapping of wolves going on. So we have to provide for that base level of sustainability and the sustainability of the trapping population. So in no ways are we endangering the long-term sustainability of that predator population.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Follow-up?
Follow-up.
Did you ever once comment that you would rather see the predator control over wolves happen in the fall?
I don't ever remember commenting on that. I would imagine that the board may have approved some fall predation control, but I don't ever remember myself commenting on that.
Okay.
Maybe I did, but I don't recall.
Representative Rauscher?
I'm good. Thank you very much.
Great. Representative Hannon?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Lang, it's pleasure to have you here. We had a nice conversation when you came in to meet with me. In the last couple of weeks, I've been thinking about in your position, you have the opportunity and have, you know, an extensive professional background in both habitat and sport fisheries, and I don't want to get into fish politics directly, but committee now knows one of my songbird refrains in talking about resources, and that is the impacts of climate change on Alaska. And I think that fish and game is in kind of a unique environment to see and think about it in regards to what it does to impact the resources Alaskans depend on to feed their families. And I know having been married to a fishery scientist, sometimes when he wants to talk about specific fisheries populations, he gets stuck in the specific fish science of why king salmon populations are where they're at. And I'm looking to see whether you've started to think about it in the big view of how we look at fish and game resources and management and take into account climate change that is impacting Alaska's fish and game resources today. We've got populations moving in new areas. We know that there are some ocean conditions that are affecting our king salmon and sockeye salmon, and wondering if shed a little light on your views around what we can do to protect our fish and game resources in perpetuity and account for changes in the ecosystem that are coming fast.
Well, I was part of the Governor Palin's climate change subcabinet, and we actually, as the Department of Fish and Game, actually, I think the only department that has a climate change strategy on our website, and I was one of the authors of that. I'm not going to get involved with what's causing it, but it would be irresponsible for me as a manager of fish and game resources to not factor climate change into how we manage our fish and game resources, from as simple of a decision of adjusting hunt seasons because of differences in terms of, you know, later fall seasons, or from how we count moose. So ocean conditions are changing. So, yeah, I'm going to factor, you know, changing climate as I do any other factor in how we manage our fish and game resources. Sometimes it's going to be a more important factor and more immediate factor, for instance, a season on a moose. Sometimes it's going to be less of a factor because there's more immediate decisions on meeting escapement objectives for king salmon.
Thank you.
Representative Sponholz.
Thank you, Chair Lincoln. So you said another thing earlier that got me thinking a little bit. You know, you're talking about active management of our resources to sort of, you know, help put food on the tables of Alaskans, and I appreciate that. My first food actually was salmon that my mom caught. Sometimes when we talk about active management, it sort of lends itself to this idea that we're managing Alaska's, wild fisheries and mammals like we manage, you know, cattle, which it seems like those are very different kinds of things. Can you talk about how it is that you incorporate, you know, science into an active management strategy?
Well, again, with predator management, we're doing it based on the science policies that we implemented 4 or 5 years ago. But there's active management is kind of a broad term. We can either let our resources vary within their natural ranges, which is what the federal government now is asking us to do on national wildlife refuges, mm-hmm. where we can actually manage them for public use, for some long-term sustainability. Mm-hmm. So I'm more in favor of managing for long-term sustainability, incorporating human use as a factor, rather than managing just within natural mm-hmm. ranges, which means moose can go from zero to whatever number, or bears can go from zero to whatever number. And that could incorporate management of harvest. That can incorporate management of harvest opportunity, that can look at management of habitat, management of predators. It's the management of the ecosystem incorporating human use as a factor.
Okay, another follow-up, thanks. I might want to have a whole separate conversation with you that we don't need to have the whole group in, because I'd like to learn more about that and understand that. But I want to follow up on another issue. When you mentioned fisheries and fish politics, and that is a very complicated area of politics in the state of Alaska. One of the things, you know, in my neck of the woods that has been on a lot of people's minds has been the reduced productivity of fisheries in South Central Alaska, and a lot of concerns that there may be, you know, a prioritization of one fisheries use group over another fisheries use group that may be negatively impacting personal use and subsistence fishing in South Central Alaska. Do you have any comment on that?
Well, again, I manage according to the management plans given to me by the Alaska Board of Fisheries. Mm-hmm. So the Board of Fisheries gets to decide the allocation of those resources in Cook Inlet, and we will abide by those. I will use my emergency order authority to make sure we're meeting our escapement objectives and we're managing within the confines of their management plans.
Is there any recommendations that you would make to the Board of Game that, you know, moving forward, or is any or any research or, you know, strategies you're going to be sort of exploring that you might present to them in the future?
Well, I would hope that the board gives me sufficient management flexibility to be able to accomplish the goals that they've given me. Mm-hmm. So, for instance, one of the things that I'm exploring is whether I have sufficient management authority to be able to commercially fish in Cook Inlet without drawing the bank account down to zero and still have some personal use opportunity. Mm-hmm. So, because I think the board wants to provide that balance between commercial and personal use and sport opportunities. So I want to have enough management flexibility to be able to do that. Mm-hmm. But again, that mix is decided by the Board of Fish, not by me.
Thanks.
Okay, we'll take a few more questions and comments from the committee, then open it up to public testimony, then come back to the committee. And up next is Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Let's see which question I want to ask. I'll ask this one. So in a September commentary, you had mentioned about the ocean acidification and about the blob that may be affecting our salmon runs. What would you like, or how would you approach those problems? Or what would you like to be able to do about it?
That's a really good question. I've been giving it a lot of thought over the last 2 or 3 months, because there's not a lot I can do in the ocean. I remember Senator Stedman asked me, what do you need? I need a magic wand that Disney character has that I can go over to the North Pacific Ocean and make it a little bit, you know, cooler. I sit on a lot of different boards and commissions. I'm finding that out. I sit on like 30 of them. So I'm trying to find the right international and national thing that we can go out and start exploring and understanding what's happening out in the North Pacific Ocean, because in many cases we're meeting our escapement objectives, but we're just not getting a return back on them. And is it bycatch out there? I think part of it may be bycatch, and so we're exploring whether through the North Council we can start looking at some kind of rationalization over fisheries that gives us a benefit back on reduced bycatch out in those fisheries. But if it's temperature related, the most I can do is assure we're putting enough fish in the bank, which is escapements. And right now we have a cruise that's operating between Russia and Vancouver that's going across and doing some high seas netting out there and temperature regimes to find out whether or not food predation is an issue or just exactly what salmon are out there and what their origins are. I think we need more of that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And up next is Rep. Rauscher.
Yeah, thank you. Through the chair, I have to apologize. I had to go out and meet with somebody that I had an interview with, promised, and I might have missed what you have said. But my question is, so what do you see right and what do you see wrong? What do we need to change and what do we need to what do we need to improve on?
Well, I think that's a hard answer, but clearly the way I look at it is are you guys getting a good return on your investment right now? So I look at it as you're entrusting me with a budget of about $197 million, and $65 million of that's general fund. And I think it's fair for you to hold me accountable. What am I returning in terms of that investment? And so right now, when I do the economics of it, the way I look at it in our economic surveys, I'm returning about $11 billion of return onto it. So I think overall the department's doing a pretty good job of managing our resources in terms of giving a return back to the state in terms of economic opportunity. Could we do better with more money? Certainly. We could do a lot worse if we had less money, I can tell you that, because every time I have less money in my pocket, I am going to be more conservative in how I manage our fish and game resources. And every time I'm more conservative, that results in less economic opportunity back to the state. So I could get into specific projects and things, but overall, I think I look at it as a return on investment and the general ability to feed people across our state, and I think we're doing a pretty good job of that.
All right, thank you.
Representative Hopkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You were talking about economic benefit to the state and the Board of Game being your boss, kind of in a way, that in terms of your regulation authority. Without delving into how the seats on that Board of Game being designated, I know none of them are specifically designated, do you see a value in having a non-consumptive user on that Board of Game and how their voice would add to the way you regulate our fish and game?
Well, again, the Board of Game appointments aren't my choices. So they go through the governor's office, boards and commissions, and it's the governor's choice and your decision to do that. I tend to look at board appointments as people that are going to add value to the board and be participating and making good decisions. They could be wildlife viewers. They could be hunters. I've seen hunters characterized that are on the board that have value added in terms of wildlife viewing decisions. So I look for people that are on that board when I'm giving advice that are going to be active participants, willing to serve on that board, do their homework, and make informed decisions.
Thank you.
Thank you, Rep. Hopkins. So at this time, we'll open it up for public testimony. Is there anyone in the room that would like to testify? I don't see anyone in the room. We have, looks like, three people online that would like to testify today. Mr. Rohr, are you there?
Yes. Good afternoon, Chairman Lincoln. I am here in Kodiak, the LEO.
Okay. Please introduce yourself for the record and provide your testimony. I'll try to limit it to 3 minutes.
Okay, will do. For the record, my name is Sam Rohr. I'm the president of the Alaska Professional Hunters Association, and I will be testifying in support of the confirmation of Mr. Doug Vincent Lang as commissioner of the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. I appreciate you hearing my testimony this morning or this afternoon. Acting Commissioner Vincent Lang is committed to building trust between the Department of Fish and Game and the public. APHA found in his previous position when he was Director of Wildlife that he was willing to meet with stakeholders and work through tough, controversial issues. We didn't always agree with the outcomes of those meetings, but we knew that our perspective was always listened to, and we would come out of those meetings knowing where the director stood on those issues. This is absolutely crucial to establishing trust. I'd also like to point out that during Commissioner Vincent Lang's tenure as Director of Wildlife, it became clear to us that his number one priority was wildlife conservation and sound scientific management. He is an absolutely staunch supporter of State Wildlife Management Authority, and he's committed to maintaining the Alaska Department of Fish and Game as a preeminent fish and game department in North America. We respectfully ask that you support the confirmation of Mr. Vincent Lang as Commissioner of the Alaska Department of Fish and Game, and that you move his name forward. Thank you for your consideration, and if you have any questions, I'm happy to answer them at this time.
Are there any questions for Mr. Rohr from the committee? I don't see any, and I know I've expressed this before, but I still think you have the coolest name for a hunting guide, Mr. Rohr.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Moving on to Sylvia Panzarella.
Yes, as you said, my name is Sylvia Panzarella. Thank you for hearing us. I'm calling for myself and my husband, Marius Panzarella. We've lived in Alaska now for almost 20 years, and first in Kodiak for many years, and now in Anchorage for the last few. I'm calling to say that we strongly oppose the appointment of Mr. Doug Vincent Lang as ADF&G commissioner. We're not opposed to ethical hunting for food. That's one of the wonderful things about Alaska. I mean, it's a great privilege, and for some, it's a necessity to put meat in our freezers. However, Mr. Vincent Lang's ideas for management of our wildlife comes straight off the page of the Safari Club International's rule book. And in case some of you are unfamiliar with this group, and I would suggest that you Google that, but they are the international group who has often killed elephants, lions, and even endangered species as long as you have the big dollars to pay for it. And they do. Mr. Vincent Lang has been an officer of the Alaska chapter of the Safari Club for many years, and he remains an officer right now. Also, as a standing commissioner, he even appointed a registered lobbyist for the Safari Club to be director of the Division of Wildlife Conservation. That's Mr. Ed Grasser. This is an extremist, unethical group, which I refuse to call hunters. They use cruel methods on many occasions in order to mark a particular animal down in their books being killed. Money is often blinding, but we don't need a commissioner who will bow down to a special interest group rather than managing wildlife for the state of Alaska. And I would like to say that predators, by the way, keep a herd healthy. They take down the sick and the weak, and they keep a strong, healthy herd in comparison to extreme sports hunters who take the biggest and the strongest. This style of management of wildlife creates an unnatural number of certain species, specifically for primarily outside hunters. So one thing affects another, including the grass, the predators, the caribou or moose. And this idea comes not from me, but from some old-time Alaskan biologists and native elders, which I have the greatest respect for. So for these reasons, we oppose Mr. Doug Vincent Lang and for the good of the state of Alaska. So thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Panzarella. The next person on the list is Mark Richards. Are you there, Mr. Richards?
Good afternoon, Chair Lincoln and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mark Richards. I'm the Executive Director of Resident Hunters of Alaska, representing some 2,000 Alaskans from across the state who support a resident hunting priority. I'm calling in from Fairbanks, where it's a 37 degrees and the roof is dripping right now, so spring is on the way. We want to express our strong support for Doug Vincent Lang as Commissioner of Fish and Game. Doug is uniquely qualified for this position with a long background with Fish and Game on both the fish and game sides, and has shown that he will stand up for states' rights as commissioner and the ability for Alaska to continue to manage our wildlife as we deem best. While we expect there may be areas of disagreement with the new commissioner on some issues, the one thing we've always respected about Mr. Vincent Lang is his willingness to engage with the public and groups in ways that try to bring us together instead of apart. That is a great asset because, as everyone on this committee knows, fish and game management can be controversial at times. I'm going to keep it brief, so in closing, we hope you'll vote to move Mr. Vincent Lang's name out of committee for a full confirmation hearing before the entire legislature. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Richards. I don't see anyone else online for testimony, and last chance to anyone in the room that would like to testify as a member of the public. Seeing none, we'll close public testimony. Are there any other questions or comments from committee members? Ms. Rasmussen, Representative Rasmussen.
Yes, Mr. Vincent Lang, can you, for the record, state that, or I guess explain if you feel that there's any conflict with you being a member or an officer of the Safari Club?
I have resigned from the Safari Club International, and I joined Safari Club International for one reason. When I resigned from being the wildlife director, there were a couple things I still wanted to proceed on. One was working with the Safari Club to make sure the department had money coming in to do some research projects, because we annually conduct that Safari Club banquet, and portion of the funds are used to give back to the department on conservation projects. And there were two conservation projects that I was very interested in having finalized. One was a sheep project, and the other one was a Prince William Sound Bear project. So those got funded because I was a chair of the conservation committee. And the other one that I was very interested in pursuing was the thing I told you guys all about, is getting kids outside. So we annually donated $25,000 of that Safari Club banquet back into the Outdoor Heritage Foundation, which did a lot of outdoor education work. So those were my interests in the Safari Club.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Representative Tallarico.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for being here today, Mr. Vincent Lang. We appreciate you coming in to talk to the committee. One of the ugly issues that I'm sure we're going to deal with again as legislators is the MOVI issue that's been around, and I can appreciate the folks that have an emotional attachment to it, for sure. I think we've all probably gone through that. We have one group of people that wants us to deem every piece of livestock in the state of Alaska as a dirty animal, and others that would choose to have us totally ignore the idea that we've found some MOVI in some of our wild game. So I was just wondering, It's my opinion anyway. I'll give you my opinion. It's my opinion that we still need to do some science on this, and I know we've done some research into this. And would you agree that we really that we have to explore this a little bit further and do some more science before we come to any types of extreme decisions?
Okay. I think there's a balance there. I MOV is kind of like the a virus that can cause a flu. There's all kinds of different kinds of flus. There's a flu that you can have that you can be in bed for an hour with and get out of bed and feel better. But there's some flus that can kill you. So I think we do need to better understand the MOV virus. That said, I don't want to be the commissioner that sees a massive outbreak of a respiratory flu virus that kills our sheep and goat populations. So I'm looking for the right balance that isn't overly burdensome on livestock owners across our state in terms of preventing a wild an infection of a transmittal from a domestic into a wild sheep found into a wild sheep or wild goat population and protection of those populations. So we're kind of looking administratively between DNR, DEC, and Fish and Game as to what could be done. One of those things that I'm looking at is can we regulatorily or administratively mandate that a new domestic that's brought into our state has to be tested before it's brought into the state. Right now you can't bring a dog into our state without it being proved that it doesn't have rabies. And once it has rabies, it seems like the state is okay with quarantining that animal so it's not passing rabies on. So those kinds of things I think we could take a look at short of having a more burdensome regulatory requirement. But again, Yukon government just took some fairly dramatic steps to protect their wild goat and sheep populations, and I think as a state we would look pretty bad if we didn't do anything and we had an outbreak of sheep and goat and massive die-offs. So we're looking for that right balance.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Rep. Tallarico. Rep. Rocher.
Thank you, through the chair. Just out of curiosity, what are they doing that what are they doing? You said that the UConn is doing so much.
They basically,
and we're not, and we may not be doing enough. But I was wondering, what are they doing?
I'll send you the exact thing. But they've closed their borders down, so you can't basically bring an animal in without testing and prove that those animals are healthy. Mm-hmm. So that's one entry point into Alaska. Since things coming up the road has to now go through Canada, so I'm presuming an animal that's coming through the road system up the Alaska Highway, since it has to be deemed clean to come through the UConn, is clean coming in. But we have animals coming in through ferry systems and through airplane travel. So we're looking closely at what they did versus what we could do. I don't think we need to be as prescriptive as they were, but something is probably there.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions?
There's one other thing I'd like to say. I was thinking back about my answer to you about what can be fixed. I think the biggest thing that can be fixed from my perspective is communication. I think when I look at the department over the last 4 or 5 years, the department became more condensed. It didn't reach out as much. I'm really going to make an effort to, as I've been hiring people, to talk more, discuss more, and find out more. And I think that's the biggest thing we can do different.
Follow-up? I appreciate that. I have lots of friends who hunt and lots that don't, and they do have, they do see a skewed view of fish and game. And isn't it all, it's not all rosy and it's not all evil, but there's that lack of communication that could quench and it could aid some of the PR problems that you're having. Mm-hmm. So anyway, I appreciate that comment. Thank you very much.
I've got a question before we go to Rep. Rasmussen. Have you done some work in the North Slope on polar bear habitat and migratory bird management?
I was on the Migratory Bird Management Council and was director of Wildlife Division, and I was involved in polar bear issues on various different commissions and different boards with polar bears. Matter of fact, we fought fairly hard when the polar bear State of Alaska opposed the listing of polar bears under the Endangered Species Act, mostly because of the precedent that's set. And that precedent that was set now has resulted in ring seals being listed which number in 7 million. So I still feel comfortable with that decision to fight that listing of polar bears, especially since there was sufficient protection for them under the Marine Mammal Protection Act out there. We actually worked fairly hard with North Slope Borough to allow the customary and traditional hunting of polar bears to continue. Some of the early numbers were so low that they wouldn't even have allowed for the customary and traditional uses of polar bears in their parts of North Slope.
Okay, thank you. And some of the leadership from the North Slope Borough Wildlife Department asked me to pass along their regards and appreciation for your work with them.
Thank you.
Rep. Rasmussen?
Yeah, thank you through the chair. I wanted to ask quickly if the department has moved towards electronic fishing licenses, hunting licenses. And I know that that's, I actually got in trouble on that once, so I'm hoping that we're moving that direction.
We're getting closer. We were very close to having it, but then there was a fall down on the board of on the wildlife side and the game side to getting some regulations changed to the Board of Game to make it electronic licensing approval. That's going to be corrected as this next board cycle, and we should be there shortly.
Thank you.
Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is just it's an ask.
Yeah.
Your facility down there in Kodiak, on Kodiak Island, we went down to get our shrimp pop permits and our crab pop permits, but then they wouldn't issue us a fishing license first. We had to go to off site to get a fishing license at Max's store or whatever. So if you can make it so they can have fishing license, distribute fishing license right there before we.
The department didn't sell official?
Okay.
I'll check it.
Yeah, please.
They sell them.
That'd be great. That'd be awesome.
I can't believe they don't sell them down there.
So. Mm-hmm.
But shortly,
if
you'll be able to.
They had a contract with Max's or whatever that outfit is, Big Rays. I don't know if it's Big Rays is on Kodiak Island. Yeah.
Well, right shortly, there. Hopefully, my hope is that you'll be able to get one on your iPhone.
Mm-hmm. So. All right, cool. You can get them online, but if you're fishing, you're not bringing, you know, a lot of stuff with you.
Right.
You gotta have
if you're there at the Fish and Game office, it'd be nice to be able to get a fishing license.
Yeah. You should be able to get one.
So another question I have. So there's obviously been a disconnect between state and federal management of hunting and fishing and rural preference and that sort of thing. Could you just describe your views on that disconnect? Are there any pros or cons? if you have an interest in reconciling the federal and state law, how would you approach doing that?
Well, I fully support the subsistence priority under state law. It's there in the Constitution, and we will continue to provide that. I think there's a certain benefit to the state subsistence priority because over the federal subsistence priority, because under state subsistence priority, if you grew up in rural Alaska and you were, for whatever reason, displaced into an urban environment for medical reasons, socioeconomic reasons, under the federal system, you're disconnected from that rural preference to be able to go out and participate. Under the state system, you're not. So I think we learned a lot in the Yukon River when the federal government closed the Yukon River to non-federally qualified users, and a lot of people from Fairbanks and Anchorage that had lived in those villages were barred from prohibiting in those subsistence fisheries. So they went back to the state system. So you have my commitment to managing for the state subsistence priority. I think we need to work with our federal brethren on conservation issues, but I do not support some of their movements where they've gone in outside of conservation to just limit non-subsistence uses based solely on quality of hunting experiences and other things. Because I think over the long term, they really do hurt displaced rural Alaskans from participating in those subsistence events.
Okay. Can you elaborate on the quality of the hunting experience?
So, for instance, in southeast Alaska, there were some instances where hunts were limited to non-federally qualified users, and the bag limit was reduced, not because of conservation reasons, simply because other people, the rural resident wanted to have a higher bag limit. And I think if there's no conservation reasons for those bases, the default regulations should be the state regulations.
Okay, so the subsistence priority would be, in your view, should be limited exclusively to like harvest limits and not things around access or?
The default should be the state subsistence regulations unless there's conservation reasons which under ANILCA, the reasons that the Federal Subsistence Board should be taking action to close non-federally qualified hunters.
Okay. So one of the issues in the Northwest Arctic is, you know, the caribou herd is, the population is lower than historical max. It's still relatively healthy. And we're not at the point yet where we're dramatically limiting harvest and that sort of thing, but some of the types of hunting and practices, at least from the local perspective, is impacting not just the population levels, but how local residents are able to hunt and continue to hunt in a traditional manner, like on the rivers and different, you know, along, you know, traditional migratory routes and that sort of thing. So I just want to understand what you're saying clearly. So in your view, as long as the number of animals is healthy, then there wouldn't be a role to impact how hunting takes place to benefit subsistence users?
Let's take a look at the regulation that the State Board of Game adopted to allow taking of bears out of dens in the Yukon area. That was adopted by the State Board Game largely in response to local native people coming to them and saying, we want to have an opportunity to teach our youth about how we traditionally took bears in the spring. It was a very limited opportunity. The Board of Game provided that under subsistence regulation. The Federal Subsistence Board, because they had a series of federal agencies involved with it, determined that was unethical hunting. So they closed it. So I think this default regulation should be the state regulation in that case. Okay. As long as it's not affecting conservation.
Okay.
We were meeting the needs of the local people in terms of their proposal coming to the State Board of Game.
Could you describe the top two or three conflicts in your mind that exist right now between different user groups for fishing or hunting, or what are the hot spots right now in the state as far as conflict goes?
Well, Cook Inlet is probably a conflict point between personal use and sport, because I think in salmon fishing, I limit sport to salmon fishing in this case, and commercial fishing. That's clearly a hot point, and we'll be looking at that over the next several years to try to find the right balance there. A lot of other commissioners have tried to find that right balance. I don't know if I'm going to be any more successful or not, but that's clearly one of them. I think how to meet demand for wildlife with a growing population is going to be a challenge. And I've already asked our wildlife division to look at that question, because take Nelchina caribou herd. That's how the population center of Alaska puts food on their tables. It's Nelchina caribou and Unit 16 moose. And same thing in Fairbanks, it's Unit 20 moose. So how we're going to manage those herds to meet demand as a population increases is going to be a huge challenge. And I think the third one is how we continue to return that investment back to the state of Alaska in times of these budget issues. That's going to be a challenge, because we're going to have to become more efficient in how we use our resources to continue to return that investment. And finding that right balance with the Commerce Clause that you guys were talking about earlier that benefits Alaska, realizing there's non-resident contributions to our state, is going to be a challenge.
Any other, Representative Tuck?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, we have a lot of competing demands, a lot of pulling and tugging and pushing when it comes to looking at the budget. I tell you that I think Fish and Game needs more resources now than ever before because of population growth and trying to manage our wildlife. There is no animal that can change their own population density. You know, mankind's the only one that has the ability to do that. And so without the intervention of mankind, we can't change the population. The animals just can't do it, you know. It's just not there. One of my concerns is making sure that we have a commissioner that's willing to fight for the department against the administration who has taken a lot of power away from the commissioners. And with the administrative directors all being centralized in the Office of Management and Budget, I question on how any commissioner is going to have the ability to properly manage their departments. And we're talking about science, we're talking about research. A lot of that is upfront investments. And I hope that not only do you have a listening to the governor, that you have the governor's listening ear, but that you also have the influence to make things happen for your department.
And again, I think when I look at, I've had many discussions with the governor. I wouldn't have taken this job unless I was able to have an honest dialogue with him. And at the end of the day, I think, you know, he listened, and the Office of Management Budget listened very carefully when I articulated that we, again, turn $197 million into $11 billion. And I think we were largely left intact as we move forward in this budget discussion. And I think you listened to that. So.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We're running out of time. Any other question or comment?
I just want to thank the committee. I know a lot of people don't like to go through confirmation process, but these are the people's resources, and this is a good opportunity to have a good dialogue. So thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Vincent Lang. So the Resources Committee has reviewed the qualifications for the governor's appointee to Alaska Department of Fish and Game Commissioner Doug Vincent Lang and recommends that the name be forwarded to a joint session for consideration. This does not reflect intent by any members present to vote for or against this individual during any further sessions for the purposes of confirmation. I'd ask members to please stay and sign the confirmation sheet. Our next meeting is Monday, March 11. We don't have a finance subcommittee scheduled that day, but we will still start at 1:20 p.m. We'll have a confirmation hearing for Board of Game appointee Jerry Burnett, and also confirmation hearings for Big Game Commercial Services Board appointees Jason Bunch and Tom Harris. There's no further business before the committee, so we are adjourned at 3:01 p.m.